this rainy day, we are going to bring Jesus to the new world. But before we do that, we have to talk about the final Reformation. There is a last Reformation, and it is the Roman Catholic response to the Protestant demands for reform. The New World was explored and colonized in parts by groups that were products of the Reformations of the 16th century. The Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Counter-Reformation. These groups were Roman Catholic priests, Franciscans, and Jesuits, and English Calvinists, whom we call Puritans. Franciscans, Jesuits, Puritans. It could be argued, young people, that these Christians were perhaps the most spiritually intense products, bless you, of the Reformation era. These priests and Puritans were perhaps the most intense spiritual products of the Counter-Reformation and the Reformation it responded to. So let's say just a very few words about the Catholic Counter-Reformation that produced the glorious music of Christians like Giovanni Gabrieli. The Catholic response to the Protestant Reformation in the second half of the 16th century. After Luther, after Calvin, beginning about 1545 on, the Catholic Church began to get its act together. The Pope convened a council at Trent and instituted a series of reforms. In the final analysis, however, the Roman Catholic response to the Protestant Reformation was to even more aggressively declare the supremacy of the way it saw Christianity, to declare the supremacy of its theological and institutional constructions of Christianity. One result of that aggressiveness was the papal efforts to revitalize existing monastic orders. And the Pope selected the Franciscans to emphasize even more fully the role of the Franciscans to show to the lay people what it means to live the life of Jesus, especially poverty, to emphasize its teaching and service functions. And while they revitalized orders like the Franciscans, the popes also created a new spiritual order that was responsive directly to the papacy. The only one of these orders that is directly, at the time, was that is directly responsible. It was called the Society of Jesus. What do we call those men who belong to the Society of Jesus? Jesuits. Anybody from straight Jesuit? Sometimes I have seen people from straight Jesuit. The Education Order. The Education Order. The Jesuits. Some people call them the shock troops of the Counter-Reformation. The Jesuits were created especially by the Pope and were dedicated to education and to evangelization. These new and revived monastic orders became the spiritual arm of the European Spanish conquest of the Catholic worlds in America. What become the Catholic worlds in America? The Franciscans, for instance, came with the Spanish military to Central and South America in the 16th century. And there, as I'm sure most of you know, they created a mission system dedicated to converting the Indians, but also dedicated to subject them to a form of peonage, if not slavery. By 1700, The largely Franciscan mission systems was extended north to the Pueblo peoples of the American Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico. I think it's fair to say that the Franciscans were not particularly good at relating to and with the Native Americans whom they were to serve. It made them not all that good missionaries, I think. They did not, for instance, identify on the individual level with Native peoples. This was most dramatically shown in their refusal to learn the language of the Native Americans. They spoke through interpreters. And in the 17th century, with increasing firmness, the Franciscans tried to root out much of the religious practices of the Pueblo peoples. In response, in the later 17th century, the Native Americans rose in rebellion and for a few decades kept the Spaniards at bay. But in the late 17th century, the Spaniards reconquered the Pueblo people. But by that time and throughout the 18th century, the Spaniards in general and the Franciscans in particular proved to be a little more accommodating to the religious practices of the Native Americans. And the Spaniards and the Native Americans together created a rich Roman Catholic Native American symbiotic culture that becomes one of the most important characteristics of that part of the country that will become finally part of the United States. Now, how brief and superficial is that? Let's see if it can be as brief and superficial with the Jesuits up in New France. In New France, Canada, beginning around 1630, the Jesuits were the representatives of the church almost entirely. And at the risk of romanticizing them, which many people have done actually, the Jesuits, it seems to me, were much more adept at evangelism than the Franciscans were. For one thing, they never tried to create permanent institutions. They created no mission system or anything like that. They instead focused on individual contact. And in order to have individual contact with the Native Americans, they first had to find them. And in those wonderful boats, in Canada winters and everything, they helped explore Canada, the St. Lawrence River Valley. And they became some of the best known explorers of French Canada. They also learned the language of the Native Americans. They often performed heroic deeds of courage and endurance. For those deeds, they were sometimes by the Native Americans rewarded by what or with what? Guess. Martyrdom. Many of them were slain by the people they tried to serve. Now, let me say just a word, having talked about the Franciscans, the Jesuits, about the Puritans, and then we'll come back to all of this. This is introduction. The Puritan clergies were the leader of the decades of the 1620s in creating in New England probably the most learned, well-educated colonial effort in the history of the world. The Puritan clergy, very well educated in England, dominated the world that they created on the rocky coast of New England. And there they helped establish an intellectually demanding form of Calvinism that was for many generations to be the foundation of New England society, and that remains today one of the cornerstones of modern American culture. And these well-educated Calvinists, these Puritan ministers, tried with varying degrees of enthusiasm and with varying degrees of success to share their religious system with the Native Americans of the Northeastern woods. Now, these Protestants and Catholics had several assumptions in common when they tried to take the gospel to the Native Americans. And they shared some of the same problems. For instance, things in common. All Christians, Catholic and Protestant, believe that Jesus was a precious salvific gift of God that must be shared with all souls. And whatever they might think of those souls, most Western Christians assume that the red people of the New World had them. Most assume that they had a soul, that they were human like they were, and that for that reason, their humanity had a claim on their Christianity, and they had to share the gospel with them. But Catholic and Protestant Christians also shared a problem when they tried to convey a system based on the concept of individual sin to a people who didn't know what they were talking about, who had no idea what the concept of individual sin meant. The Indians did not know what the missionaries meant, Catholic or Protestant, when they said that they made Jesus angry or sad when they sinned against him. They knew what it meant to do bad things to individuals. But they had never met this man named Jesus. They knew what it meant to betray the people, the community. But they could not conceive of sin as a form of spiritual sickness. They therefore could not fathom the Christian idea of atonement, of Jesus' dying for people's sins. I submit to you that as a missionary, this is a serious problem. So, let's turn now and talk more completely about the first of these Christians who get to the New World, the Catholics. I've entitled this part of the lecture, Jesus the Body. And in some sense, the most important thing that could be said about the Jesus that the Franciscans and the Jesuits took to the Native Americans is that he was material. He was visible. He was, yea, even portable. You could carry Jesus around. We've just spent 3 weeks talking about this Jesus. You should know something about him. You should know what he looks like. You should know what the importance of what the way he looks is. Well, Jesus came to the New World in the Catholic form of Christianity pretty much like he did in the early modern world in Europe. He was Jesus the body. And he was more specifically Jesus the suffering body. And the body, the suffering body of Jesus, could be represented in pictures that you could show, in carvings that you could show and carry around, in statues that you could carry around. And then finally, what symbol could you use to show the suffering of Jesus? The cross, the crucifix. good for you. Jesus, the body, came to the new world in that same crowded Christian cosmos that we talked about. He was embodied, embedded in a world of institutions and hierarchy, ritual, ceremony, in a world in which the calendar and the rhythms of life are dictated by things having to do with him and his life and ministry. This Jesus also was surrounded by his holy family, especially by his holy mother, the Virgin Mary, who, it turned out, had a special affinity for her children in the New World. Folks, do you know that the patron saint of the Americas is, yes, Mary. The Virgin became the patron saint of the New World. And especially in Mexico, who did she become? The Lady of Guadalupe. The patron saint is particularly, gloriously, of Mexico. Our Lady had a particular affinity for her children in the New World, as it turned out. And folks, that's real good for the Catholic. He was also surrounded by all those saints, as he was in Europe. And he had his cross. At times, Jesus was represented on the cross, bloody, heroic, giving his life for all. I hope you have in your mind now an armory of pictures. But his cross could also be a symbol of what? What could the white man also do with the cross? Oh, turn it into a sword? Well, they already had swords. They hadn't turned the cross into swords. What else could they do with the cross? It could also be a sign of what? Not obvious enough. How do you lay? Yes. Resurrection? Not exactly what I had in mind. You're thinking too much about religion. You're not cynical enough. You're not material enough. A badge, power, Michelle. What? What kind of power? What could you use it to signify? God is on our side. How about if you just plunk it down somewhere? What? Someone said it. Someone said it. Raise your hand. Ownership. Can you say conquest? More often than the flag, the conquest of the Native Americans' physical land was signified by planting the crucifix. You're going to see it today in just a minute. Ownership. I like ownership actually better than conquest. The Catholic priest found that they had several Jesuses to present to the Indians. One of the themes of Dr. Miller's course is that Jesus comes in lots of varieties. That's why he's still around. The Jesus who clearly most fully resonated with the Native Americans was Jesus the, what would you think? Jesus the what? Was it? Thank you. Miracle worker. Folks, he's the most impressive Jesus. He's Mark's Jesus. He's the first Jesus. And he's the Jesus that most resonated with the New World. For just like the Westerners, these Native Americans, guess what? Lived in a magical world. The Indians lived in a magical world no less than these early modern European Christians. And like those European Christians, they had their magic workers. They had their priests. What were they called? Shaman. Like the priest, the Native American shaman were adept. There's that word again, adept. good at, specialized in manipulating the natural world and somehow getting to the supernatural world and making it do things. Jesus' most powerful magic, of course, was to do what? Heal, cure sickness. Why was this particularly effective for the Native Americans? Because they were getting sick from whom? From the Europeans. I trust I have to tell you that. The worst ecological epidemic in the world, pandemic, almost wiped out the Native Americans. The white man brought the disease, but guess what the white man also brought, young people? The cure. Jesus, the cure. What is the most extreme form of healing? What's the worst sickness there is? Death. Thank you very much. Can I get a witness? Yeah. And Jesus healed. He raised people from the dead. And then what did he really do finally then to show off really? He raised him on his own self. His own self. Can't believe I said that. Raised yourself from the dead. But he did. Folks, it's a great story. It's a great story. Line up for Jesus. It's a great story. And it worked for some people. For most, it didn't. The cross, a sign of conquest, was also then an agent of healing. The ritual formulations of the Catholic clergy. I'm sorry. I'm going to try to say that again. The ritual formulations of the Catholic liturgy. The ritual formulations of the Catholic liturgy could also work miracles. Can you name one? What's the back? Communion. There's a miracle there, but there's another miracle. Baptism. Baptism puts a stamp on you, makes you Jesus' own. They're both miraculous. We're going to see this in just a minute. Folks, there was something extraordinarily powerful for many Native Americans in the rite, the R-I-T-E, of anointing with water for healing. We're going to see it in just a minute. Jesus was, you tell me, I'm going to continue to pester you. What else shows Jesus' power about his life? What else could you tell these folks about Jesus that would make them think he was powerful? What is it? He's coming back. You know, they didn't think that was very good. Because what was he going to do then? Terrible things. So let's not talk about that. Jesus renounced something in his life. And it gave him power amongst these people. What? Poverty? Did he renounce poverty? That's not exactly what you want to say, is it? But he was poor. They were too. He renounced something. He set himself apart from something that almost all people do. What is it? They didn't understand sin, though. But they understand this one. Let's just say it. Would you just say it out loud, girl?
Sex.
Sex. Thank you very much. You don't think about it, do you? Folks, what is the power of celibacy? What sets these weird men apart? They have renounced something that most of you can't imagine renouncing. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But anyhow, we assume that Jesus did. Right? Folks, this gave him power. And they used it, actually. You haven't thought about that, have you? The celibacy of Jesus also allowed the priests to denounce all forms of sexual perversion that they found. basically polygamy amongst the Native Americans. But finally, the most important and powerful Jesus they had to offer was Jesus the martyr. Here was a religion based on a hero who gave his life for the people. Folks, this resonated. Don't talk to me about sin. I don't understand. But talk to me about a hero who gives his life for the people. And before he dies, what did the hero do for the people? He gave them a rite, a ceremony. What did he tell them to do? Eat my body. Drink my blood. Resonate, 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 resonate. Powerful. They knew about that. Folks, the concept of devouring the body of the king is one of the oldest and most powerful among the species. That's why my kids decided that the UT team 3 or 4 years ago should eat Bevo. Many of the Native peoples had cosmologies that contained similar instances of redemptive sacrifice for the people. Jesus was scourged before he was dead, before he was killed, wasn't he? Many of these peoples had flagellation ceremonies. Folks, not just Native Americans. The Roman Catholic Church had flagellation ceremonies for years. Flagellation ceremonies that resonated with Jesus' torture at the hands of the Romans. Some Native Americans, in fact, practiced ritual torture that included something like the crucifixion. We know that some of these Native Americans who didn't become Christians had, in fact, learned about these rituals, though. On two different occasions, we know from memoirs that Jesuits were killed by being baptized 3 times. By guess what? Boiling water. But you know what? They knew what baptism was. Now, I'm going to try to illustrate some of these ideas by sharing with you today and then next time another remarkable film made in the last 20 years about Jesus coming to the New World with the Catholics amongst the native peoples of New France and New Spain. Today, we're going to watch Black Robe, part of it. How has anyone seen Black Robe? Has anyone seen this movie? Go to Vulcan, rent this movie. This is a wonderful movie. 1991, French-Canadian, directed by Bruce Beresford, stars Lothair Bluteau as the Black Robe. Black Robe, what does that mean? Who are they talking about? The priests who wear black robes. The Huron Indians called the Jesuits the Black Robes. They will call our missionary here the Black Robe. This movie tells the story of a young Jesuit priest in France who volunteers to replace one of his order that has died at an outpost hundreds of miles west of Quebec among the Huron Indians. He's going to replace a fallen brother. He goes to Canada and he faces all kinds of difficulty and illustrates all the weaknesses and strengths of the Jesuits as missionaries. One of the most wonderful scenes in this movie is a scene back in Quebec City in a little chapel. The priest came to realize almost immediately that the Indians were fascinated not by all the stuff that they had out with the crosses, but by a clock, a wind-up clock that had a little bell on it, and at the hour, this little guy would come out and walk around. That's what they were fascinated. So they would come to the chapel and just do, have a vigil before the clock. It's really a fascinating movie. All righty. So he's going to go west with a group of comrades. He faces all kinds of difficulties, almost dies a couple of times. And in the movie, he encounters not only the Huron Indians, but their cosmos, the way they view the world. And if you really want to learn in depth about this world, rent and watch this movie. One of the people who's coming along with him is a Huron shaman. You will know who he is. He dreams, the old man dreams of his own death, how it's going to happen, where it's going to happen. He dreams then that the black robe will have to go on all alone. That's exactly how it happens. His daughter goes along with them. And she falls in love with the Black Robe's novices. The Black Robe finally arrives at the outpost only to find that there is only one priest left alive and that he and this single man are alone, surrounded by Huron Indians who are dying. There is a shaman there. He calls the Black Robe a devil and wants to kill him. But the people want to be baptized because that they believe that baptizing them will heal them. The Black Robe and the remaining priest debate baptizing people who have no understanding of the religious beliefs beyond the sacrament. The old priest wants to do it. The Black Robe says they've got to understand. The old priest dies, and the shaman finally comes to the Black Robe and asks him to baptize them. And he does.
I welcome this love.